Let's talk Tribe. And to do that, we're going to bring in Jim Ingram from the Chronicle-Telegram and the Medina Gazette. Jim, as always, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
So far, so good. And boy, I was really intrigued by something that you wrote last week about the Tribe entering the Manny Machado sweepstakes. You wrote a piece saying that the Indians should throw their name in the hat in order to give themselves a shot at acquiring the shortstop slash third baseman, knowing what it would cost. I wanted to give you a chance to explain your position on this. I think it's obvious what he brings to the table, although you only have him under control for 1 year, maybe two, if he would agree to a player option in 2019. But if you could, just kind of explain your position on this and why the Tribe should do this, knowing what it would cost.
Well, it's more than just the Tribe doing it. Obviously, the Orioles would have to agree to it, but it's a really, really unique situation. You've got a guy who's going to be a free agent after next season and probably in line for a gigantic contract when that happens. So the Orioles know they're going to lose him. So at this point, if they're wise, they'll try to make a deal and get something out of it before he leaves. So, you know, who are you going to trade him to? Half the teams in baseball are not figuring to be pennant contenders next year, so that kind of eliminates them, because why would they want to take him on? And then you've got, you know, some teams that are, that don't need a third baseman or shortstop, which he also can play. I think the Indians fit a unique and very limited slot here, where for 1 year, I think, in my opinion, it would be worth them going all out trying to get him, because even if you can't keep him, it would give you an elite Gold Glove caliber, Silver Slugger caliber third baseman to add to, obviously Lindor and Jose Ramirez, and probably give the Indians the best all-around infield in the majors. Now, what do you have to do to give up to get him? The other side of this equation is, you know, a lot of the bigger market teams have an interest in him because they think that they can sign him to a contract after he becomes a free agent after next year. But, you know, how you can match up talent-wise, what are you going to give the Orioles for him to get him, not knowing for sure if you can sign him? In the Indians' case, it would be almost, you would make the trade almost conceding you're not going to be able to keep him. So you would give him, in my opinion, you'd give him your choice of one of your top prospects, which is really what the Orioles need, because they're going to start a rebuilding phase next year, starting with the trade of Machado that everyone anticipates happening. So, you know, to me, it'd be worth it for the Indians to just say, look, you can have, name any prospect in our system, we'll give you him and maybe a couple second-tier guys. And to me, it would be worth it for 1 year of Machado, because the Indians are right now trying to win this thing right now, and they got to be all in on this thing. And they would be trading, you know, if they're their number one guy, if it's Francisco Mejia, the catcher, or Tristan McKenzie, their top pitching prospect. You know, those guys are tremendous prospects, but they're prospects, and they're not proven guys yet. But at the same time, they're not guys that would be on the Indians' opening day lineup. So if you were able to kind of consummate this trade, you'd get a guy, an elite player like Machado, for only 1 year, but still an elite player, for in exchange for players that wouldn't even be on your roster anyway in the coming years. So to me, it would be worth at least exploring. I don't know if the Orioles, how interested they would be in doing that, but I think it should be very interesting to them, because they'd be getting, you know, a top minor league prospect, which is more than probably they could get from some other teams that would have an interest.
Sure, and the longer this goes on, I think the asking price anyways might come down just a bit, knowing that he's going to be a free agent after next year. And I think one of the things you alluded to in there, Jim, was that the window is now for the Tribe. And I guess the question is, you know, how much longer is that window going to be open? They do have some guys under contract for a little while longer, but keeping this team together is going to be awfully difficult. You know, it's been discussed a ton. Next year, the bullpen's going to get even weaker, because it's going to be really tough to re-sign either or even both Cody Allen and Andrew Miller. So you're starting to lose some of these guys that you just don't have the ability to re-sign. So, I mean, how long do you think this window is open?
Well, I think it's reasonable to assume it'll be open as long as they can keep starting rotation, which is really the foundation of the team. And they have Kluber under control for 4 more years, and they have Carrasco and Bauer under control for 3 more years. So as long as those 3 guys are healthy, you're going to be in it, because that's one of the better rotations in baseball. But, yeah, the bullpen will become a problem. You've already lost Brian Shaw and Joe Smith this year. After next year, Andrew Miller is going to be a free agent, and I'm drawing a blank on the other. Oh, Cody Allen. So, you know, those are 2 more guys, and you take those 4. Those were your top 4 relievers in this past season. So, if you're losing those guys, you know, you're going to have to replace them somehow, and that's always a tricky thing. I will say the Indians are very good at constructing bullpens, though. They seem to have this knack of getting guys who are on the verge of emerging as relievers. Now that wasn't the case with Miller. Everybody knew he was an all-star reliever when they got him. But bullpens are very hard to predict. It is very unusual to have relievers that are consistently good year after year after year. But so you got those 2 guys are gone after next year. Brantley's a free agent after next year. Chisenhall's a free agent after next year. McAllister, who's a lesser reliever but still a guy that's been out there and has experience, he'll be a free agent after next year. So, you know, the bullpen's going to take a big hit unless you can re-sign a couple of those guys, and that would be another argument for kind of selling out, as it were, to get as much talent as you can on the roster for the 2018 season and take your best shot.
You mentioned Francisco Mejia as possible bait for Manny Machado trade, or possibly something else out there if anything were to come around. But what's the word on him? How far is he from being that guy that a team would like to bring up and make a part? I know he played a little bit with the Tribe at the end of the season last year, but how much longer does he have here?
Yeah, I mean, he's getting very close. He had another good year at Akron this past year. Presumably, if he's with the organization, would start this year at Columbus and be available if any time any of the 2 catchers on the big league roster get hurt. This is a guy that they were willing to trade, 2 years ago in the Matt LaCroix trade Jonathan LaCroix trade that fell through with Milwaukee. So, you know, it's a guy that he played his primary position as catcher, and they have depth there with Gomes and Perez, and they added a kid named Eric Haas as the 3rd catcher on the roster this year. So they have some depth there. They could afford to trade a guy like that for a guy, you know, of Machado's magnitude. Now, you know, 3 years from now, if they did make a trade like that, Machado probably be with another team, and Mejia would just be, you know, starting off on a career that could be a very good one. But I've always felt that when you have the chance to win a World Series, and then you have to give up prospects, you don't think twice about it, because prospects are prospects for a reason, because they haven't done it yet. And if you have a chance to trade for a guy that's not only done it, but done it at an elite level, you just got to go for it, because there's no guarantees. I mean, you know, we say that the pitching is solid next year, the starting pitching, but, you know, you're just 1 or 2 sore arms away from one of those guys in the big 3, and then all of a sudden that changes the whole complexion of your season. So, you know, it's a very fragile thing, but I think, this kind of a trade would be a unique one, but I think it would be worth them at least exploring it.
Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram and the Medina Gazette is our guest here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. Obviously, with Carlos Santana out of the equation, signing late last week with the Philadelphia Phillies, that leaves a void at first base. Who do you think is going to play that position for the Tribe next year, and is it possible that that guy is currently on the roster?
I don't know who's going to play it. I'm not sure they really could name you who's going to play it right now. I mean, there are some options, obviously. You know, there's been talk to move Brantley there to maybe lessen the chance of another injury, but to me that doesn't lessen it that amount, because, I mean, there's a lot of traffic going on around first base and a lot of things that can happen there that can cause injuries. You know, you could use Encarnacion there. I don't know if the, not being able to bring back Santana maybe increases their chances slightly of bringing back Jay Bruce, in which case, you know, he could play a little first base. Lonnie Chisenhall played a few days over there at first base last year. I think probably what they're going to do is wait like last year and hope that the market is light on some of these free agents now, and see if, you know, like last year, Encarnacion kind of fell into their lap. If something like that, you know, were to happen, you know, some of these guys that don't get the contracts they expect to get, and, you know, they'd be willing to you know, sign for 2 or 3 years with the Indians. You know, probably they wouldn't go over Encarnacion's contract from last year, but, you know, somebody like that could emerge, or else, you know, you could even go in and stay, keep it in-house. I mean, I've even heard Jason Kipnis's name thrown around. So, you know, it's a tough to say or predict who's going to play that spot right now. It may not be one guy. It might be two or three guys that they rotate in the first base and DH slots. So it's very early in the off season, but that's clearly going to be one of the priorities moving forward until the start of spring training.
Well, it's a lot of fun to talk about the Tribe in this regard on December 18th with the high hopes that are certainly on the table for this team, even if the window isn't going to be open a whole lot longer. Hopefully, we're talking about this Tribe team in 20 years, kind of like we were talking about the Omar Vizquel, Jim Thome era Tribe 20 years back. Speaking of which, you know, you had written a piece a few weeks ago making the Hall of Fame case for both of those guys. That's a discussion I feel like it's going to continue for a while. But in your mind, why is it that both of these guys should be getting in?
Well, I think in Thome's case, I think there's a very good chance he'll go in on the first time on the ballot. He's one of those guys that came through the steroid era kind of unscathed as far as his reputation. He was never associated with anything like that. And when you do that, when so many of the others around you in your era were associated with steroids, I think it kind of polishes your case already, because you did almost what they did and didn't cheat to do it. So I think, you know, what's 600 home runs is kind of a magic number throughout baseball. I mean, then prior to the steroid era, I think only three guys had ever gone over 600. So Tommy's there, and I think if you look at the list, if you eliminate A-Rod and Bonds, I think he's like sixth among the so-called clean sluggers of all time, you know, as far as on the home run list. So I think, you know, he had a high on-base percentage, drew a lot of walks, very durable. He very rarely missed games, played for a long time, played in both leagues, played for, you know, four or five teams. I think he's just, he has a good reputation as a person, and even a better one is just a dependable, productive slugger who hit home runs for a long time in the major leagues, which is hard to do.
No question about it. It's going to be a lot of fun to see how this plays out. I mean, I agree with you. I think there's no question he gets in. The bigger question is Vizquel, and, you know, how long would it take for him to get in? You know, people look at what he did defensively, and I think because he was so good with his glove, a lot of the work he did with his bat kind of got overlooked.
Yeah, in fact, when I was looking some stuff up on him, I was somewhat surprised to find out that no shortstop in history except Derek Jeter has more hits than Omar. He's got the second most hits of any shortstop in the history of baseball. But he's going to be the battleground guy initially here, I think, for the analytics versus the old school thinking of baseball. And because the analytics people believe that he's not even in the Hall of Fame, shouldn't even be in the Hall of Fame discussion, which I highly object to, having seen virtually every game he played for with the Indians, which were his peak years. I mean, I just don't see how. I've never liked the defensive metrics. I do think there are value in offensive metrics, and I think, you know, I don't discount metrics categorically, but I think defensive metrics are, in my opinion, so unreliable, because you don't need to be told when a guy's a great defender with numbers. You can just watch the guy play the game, and, you know, as we all did and watch in Omar's case, he made plays no one else made. He was the best defensive shortstop of his era, and, you know, was a really much better hitter than a lot of people give him credit for. But, I mean, he was as good a defensive player, not just a shortstop, but maybe any position during his peak years. And I think for that reason, and for the fact that I really don't like any of the when metrics are used to tell me that Omar Vizquel was not a good defensive player, I say that's not on Omar, that's on the metrics. That whatever system you're using to come to that conclusion, I disagree with, because, I mean, you can just see it, you know, over and over and over again for all the years he was in Cleveland. So I don't think he's going to make it the first year. I think it's going to take a little time. I think he was helped by the fact of he went to the National League and played with the Giants for a few years after he left Cleveland, and that got him some exposure in front of the National League writers who will be on voting in the Hall of Fame elections. It's going to take a while, but the metric people are very, very adamant about this fact that he's not only isn't a Hall of Famer, he's not even close to being a Hall of Famer. And so I think there's going to be a battle waged here between those that are just putting all their eggs in the analytics basket and those of us who are less married to that concept and just, you know, are going by, you know, the eye test. And he not only passed the eye test, he passed it with flying colors. So I think he's got a chance to be in the, to make it eventually, but it's probably going to be a 2 or 3 years down the road, I would say, because it's going to take some, he's an acquired taste, even though he's now no longer playing. I think his case, it's going to take some people to be making it, and some, maybe he'll get some support from some of his former peers and stuff, because I'm just astonished that this is even a debatable subject, because, I mean, he was, usually if you're the best at what you do in a given era of baseball, to me that's like the definition of a Hall of Famer, and unfortunately some of the analytics people don't agree that he was the best at what he did in his era, which is the crux of the argument.
Yes, very, very well stated. I mean, there's no question he passed the eye test. And as you just said, look, I mean, only one other shortstop in the history of baseball had more hits. So you're exactly right. He belongs in. I don't think that you get any disagreement from anybody in this city for sure. Jim, we always appreciate the time. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thank you. That's Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram and the Medina Gazette joining us here on Bullseye on the Afternoon.